Stephen Gaber, the former principal cellist of the Cleveland Orchestra, would tell his cello students at the Blossom Festival and the Cleveland Institute of Music that when he played in orchestra, he would try to feel and act like he was playing chamber music with the players around him. So whoever you sat with was your chamber music partner. This might be why string players prefer to sit on the front stands, because they are nearer the action. When you sit on the first cello stand, you are playing with your stand partner, and maybe you have a violist on your right, and the concertmaster is across from you, and the second violin's across to your right. You play with whoever is closest to you. Sometimes the pick gets configured in really strange ways, and I find myself next to the bassoons, and it makes for a different experience. In those operas where our parts are nearly identical, we think more about color, and we match articulation that makes sense in the context. Orchestras have long been environments for collaboration. We work together for a few rehearsals, and somehow the performance jumps to higher levels than the hours seem to add up to. It's truly a synergistic machine. Welcome back to A Cello Rondo. I'm Paula Tuttle, and today we're probing the concept of flow, and can we improve it in the workplace? Whether it be an orchestra, a practice room, an office, or a lab. The notion that scientists work better in collaborative environments has, of course, been documented scientifically. In other words, the picture of a lone scientist in the lab having an aha moment is more myth than reality. Office spaces have been experimenting with different plans. Do you put everyone in the same room? Or do you give everyone an office space? Or something in between? After a while, it became evident people sharing a space should have some order, but give them a chance to interact and build on each other's ideas. Having everyone in the same room with no partitions was found out to be a bad idea, and not having a common area was just as bad. One legendary success was MIT's Building 20. It was built in 1943 as a hurried war effort, which meant no one expected it to last more than a few years, which meant if knocking down a wall 1 week to make for a space for a project and building a wall another week helped create space for two projects, no one felt they were doing any harm. The building was scheduled for demolition in the next 2 years, but it ended up staying for over 50 because the building had an amazing track record for cultivating breakthrough ideas. It was dubbed the Magical Incubator. Projects including Bose Acoustics, the Radiation Lab, and a bunch of Nobel Prize-winning physicists did their work there. No one expected the building to last 55 years, so its temporary origins meant it could be reconfigured and repurposed without any bureaucratic fuss. In 2007, Microsoft built a similar structure, though not intended to be temporary. The research building in Redmond, Washington, named Building 99, was created from the ground up to be easily reconfigured to fit the needs of the employees and their projects. A mix of large spaces and closed-door offices were essentially built around a water cooler idea. After the success of Building 20, companies started recognizing the need for configuring workspaces to allow for flow and collaboration. In a music ensemble, we just pick up our instruments and put them where they work best. In a pit, on a stage, in a recording studio with separation booths. So for a Mozart program, the music director might want the first violins on stage left and the second violins on stage right for an antiphonal effect. At the Benedum, we've put the first violins where the seconds are traditionally, meaning the middle of the orchestra next to the winds, because it's a position where they can project best in the pit. But I think I've sat in every part of the pit in my years of opera and ballet orchestra. The only thing that's for sure is the cellos move as a herd. We sometimes get a little strung apart, but the group is always in close proximity. Same with the winds. I don't remember ever having the clarinets and oboes on opposite sides of the pit. Unless the players are part of an on-stage set, it makes sense for us to be playing together in close enough range to play together. The players need to build on each other's parts. My friends who are ballet dancers often asked how long it takes for the orchestra to prepare a program like a ballet, because dancers take months to prepare for the same production. And they're surprised that we only have 2, but optimally 3, reading sessions before the dancers are put with the orchestra. The individuals of an orchestra can learn their music on their own, but there's very little a dancer can practice alone, at least until the ballet master and choreographer have given them extensive instructions in person. Also consider the notion that dancers have to change their location. If they weren't moving to various points of the stage, the work would be exponentially simpler. If I had to move to different parts of the stage, well, I too would need a bunch more rehearsals. So this idea of static versus flow comes into play. An office building with all closed doors is on one end of the continuum, and a busy city sidewalk on the other. Neither will really create a flow of ideas. One is too busy, and the other is too isolated. Building 99 was built as if the water cooler was the nexus of ideas. It was designed to conjure up liquidity, spillover, in mixed spaces, create flow, and places for ideas to collide. It tapped 14th century Genoa and 20th century Greenwich Village. It recognized the place between chaos and control was where innovation gets gritty and gets down to business. So what about ideas? Again, are they sparks, aha moments, or is it the revisiting of a hunch, the gut feeling you get that you put on the back burner that turns into the Nobel Prize? It's been a contested subject. The cop that gets a gut feeling and shoots. Is it okay? Or is the gut feeling you get about someone who you see periodically over months and recognize something's off, is that more reliable? There's a thing called the slow hunch. It's the one you write down and revisit another day. And if it still rings true in your gut, it's the real deal. There's a very famous memo and is now tagged the Phoenix Memo. It got lost in the system of email files at the FBI in the summer of 2001. And it's been looked at from all angles as to why it never surfaced and warned the people upstairs about the plan for 9/11. The best reasons to date are that the email systems weren't as effective then as they are now. A memo like this wouldn't fall into an abyss. Networks have grown and improved in every corner of the world, and that's good news. The memo was 6 pages, but one sentence advised of a coordinated plan. Maybe terrorists were sending students to the U.S. to attend aviation schools. The author of the memo was Ken Williams, who urged the high-level offices to start flagging anyone who attempts to obtain a visa to attend a flight school. Sadly, the memo was viewed by an analyst, and it was deemed non-critical, and it was put away in a drawer. So today, in 2023, there are a couple of good reasons why a warning shot like that wouldn't just get put in a file. Because there was another incident that happened 3 weeks later, and the two incidents colliding in that way makes Williams' hunch seem more plausible. Al-Qaeda member Zacharias Moussaoui was arrested in Minnesota in August of 2001 on an immigration violation, and he was taking flight training at the time. If the FBI cross-referenced these two incidents in real time and looked up all the visas of Al-Qaeda flight students, well, history might have played out differently. Sure, that's a lot of ifs, and in today's world, the two incidents would get noticed as a pattern. The collaboration of these two reports would pop up. As it was, it took weeks to get a search warrant to look at Moussaoui's laptop, and on the day of 9/11, they were finally allowed to see the laptop, and they concluded Moussaoui might try to fly something into the World Trade Center. Had the Williams memo been on the landscape and not in some black hole, it would have leveraged the courts to allow the laptop to be accessed. After 9/11, the task of detecting subtle patterns in real time became the first order of business. The Total Information Awareness Project was the first attempt at this, but it's really taken at least a decade to make us safer in this regard. I often shake my head that this obvious need for sharing of information is so elusive in bureaucratic institutions. What's standing in the way? People's egos? Or systems that just don't accept outsiders, that shield knowledge from members operating on a need-to-know basis? It took the FBI 10 years to break away from this kind of thinking. They just didn't know how to share with other agencies and even in their own agency. I'm just glad the government is starting to collaborate amongst themselves. You kind of want to point to what we do and say, hey, we all play on the same beat. We might not agree on anything else, but when we play our instruments, the music is the higher authority. It's a tacit agreement. Do your job. Do it well. Hear your partners and your colleagues and your subordinates. And maybe listen to your hunches and let your hunches simmer and revisit them. Ken Williams developed his hunch over months. The Minnesota Aviation School hunch came to the flight instructors in a matter of hours. The former one, the slower one, is historically the one that makes real change in the world. But the latter one resulted in an action. The Al-Qaeda aviation student was arrested. So what gives? Darwin kept a journal, and he reread his notes constantly. At that time, these kinds of journals by writers and scientists were dubbed commonplace books. In his commonplace book, Darwin carefully and methodically wrote about his ideas of evolution. Then he moved on to geology, setting aside his thoughts about evolution. He visited the Galapagos Islands and wrote down everything he saw in great detail, with no thoughts of evolution on his radar. When he reread his notes about evolution, and then again about the birds on the islands, he conflated his ideas, and his theory of evolution finally solidified. The other part of this not to be left out is he talked about his ideas to colleagues, friends, and other scientists. He found the place between chaos and control with his experimentation and keeping notes in his commonplace book. He had an organized method for developing ideas and reviewing them. So the moral of this story, ideas need to be kept alive. They need oxygen. They need sunshine. They need to overlap and they need to be reviewed. And they need to be shared. And I think orchestras hit on this a long time ago. Might be why it's so hard to record an orchestra, because everything is flowing. There's no way of separating things out. Once you put them in a recording studio and you try to put separation there, we've really lost something. We take down the walls, we take down the barriers, and we let things go. Moving between chaos and control. If this sounds familiar to your life's work as a musician, keep doing what you're doing. You've hit the mark, the middle ground, the sweet spot. Have a great week. I'll post these books in the show notes at accelerandocast.com. And I'll see you next time.